wasn't going to move very fast, even with an open throttle. But then, after an eternity, the vehicle appeared behind its single headlight, and Gentry cussed aloud. It was a tiny motorized rickshaw, a scooter with a covered three-seat bench behind the driver, a feeble two-stroke engine, and a wide tricycle-type rear axle. Gentry was pissed. This was probably the slowest vehicle in existence, with the exception of a donkey cart. Still, he recognized it would be a hell of a lot better than jogging, so he stepped into the dark road. He did not try to topple the little vehicle. Instead, he just flagged it down. The rickshaw pulled over. A black man in a turban sat behind the handlebars. "Taxi?" he asked, no shock or surprise at the sight of a bearded white man in a military-style jumpsuit. Apparently, Court wasn't the first foreigner to wander stupidly around in the darkened suburbs of Al-Fasher. He climbed in hurriedly, and the driver twisted the throttle forward on his handlebars, sending the machine slowly again on its way, with a whine like a lawnmower in thick, wet grass. Court told the driver to take him to Al-Fasher's souk, or marketplace. Every town has a market, he assumed, and apparently this backwater was no different, as the driver did not press him further. Instead, as the 40-ish Darfuri tribesmen set off for town, he turned back to his fare and offered to sell him a drink from a tiny cooler he kept in the back seat. Court checked it out, saw a half dozen bottles of tepid water, the bottle's caps safety seals broken. Gentry admitted to himself that he was thirsty, but he wasn't about to chug old plastic bottles refilled with local tap water. Also on the floor, he found a small repair kit for the rickshaw in a burlap bag. There was nothing of interest to him in the kit, save for a single red road flare and a small, rusty screwdriver. Court pocketed the flare and the tool as the first vestiges of an idea began forming in his mind. They headed east for no more than 3 minutes before they hit the bustle of the city. Nearly a fourth of the vehicles on the road were powered by donkeys instead of engines, and suddenly the two-stroke job under the seat of the rickshaw did not seem quite so impotent in comparison. Another third of the vehicles on the road were NGOs of some sort. UN, UNICEF, CARE, the Red Cross. Additionally, there were some UNAMID military vehicles on the road and GOS Army men on motorcycles. The last 10% of the traffic were locals in cars and trucks. They were very much a minority on their own streets. He pressed the driver to hurry more than once, but even with the slow speed, he imagined himself to be well in front of the NSS sedan, which had gone far in a different direction to meet up with the highway. He knew, however, it would only take one traffic jam or missed turn to make this a close race. They pulled up to the marketplace and stopped.
"Here is the souk, £20.
Court said, "I want you to take me to the ghost house." He was hardly surprised that the man jerked his head around to look back at his passenger. No one wanted to go to the secret police interrogation facility. Court had already yanked a fat wad of cash from his wallet. He held it up for the man to see. But whatever the value of the currency in his hand, it was not enough.
"I don't know this place. Here is the souk. You want a drink? Many soda stands still open. Tea stands. It very nice."
"I don't want a fucking soda. I want the NSS headquarters. Just get me near there. Show me where it is. I will walk the rest of the way." Court now lifted another lump of wrinkled notes out of his wallet. From the light of a storefront powered by a roaring and smoking gas generator, Gentry looked into the wide eyes of his driver. He nodded slowly at the money, then up at the insane American.
"I take you 2 blocks from there. I take you to soccer stadium."
"The soccer stadium is 2 blocks from the ghost house?"
"Yes,"
said the man with a nod. Court could see the nervous tension. He felt sure the man was telling the truth. "Good. More money if you go faster." The man turned back to face the road ahead, leaned forward into his handlebars, and seemed to twist out another horsepower or two from the impotent machine. Just then, Gentry heard a noise high in the sky above him. He knew what it was instantly. He really did not even have to look. But he did look and saw the silhouette of an Ilyushin IL-76MF climbing into the starry heavens. "Motherfucking Russians," he muttered, but he couldn't say he blamed them. Cort felt incredibly alone, but there was no time to think of that now. He needed a plan. In seconds, they were stuck in the evening traffic again, stationary in the middle of the street. Court's driver's honking was lost in the melody of louder car horns. A donkey cart on the right of the rickshaw pushed forward a few feet, and Court caught a glimpse of the unpaved promenade running alongside the road. There, under the light of a bare bulb hanging out a second-floor window, a man sat on an overturned metal bucket resting on the ground. Beside him was a container the size of a beer keg with a rubber hose snaking out of the top of it and looping down the side. In front of the contraption stood a handwritten sign in wood, the writing in both Arabic and English. Gas. The man picked at his dinner of rice with his fingers. Immediately, Gentry leaned into the front of the rickshaw, reached past the driver, and pulled the keys from the ignition. "I'll be right back," Court said, but this did not stop the man from shouting at him when Gentry left him behind in the center of the busy street as he ran to the gas man. Court pulled out his wallet hurriedly, yanked another fold of Sudanese pounds free, and handed them to the man. The elderly gasoline vendor took them and stood, nodded quickly, but then looked the hurried Westerner over curiously. Court didn't get it for a second, so he said, "Gas," pointing at the keg. Behind him, cars and motorbikes began honking, and those on horse and mule carts began yelling at the stationary rickshaw blocking traffic. Court shouted, "Gas!" one more time, then realized the vendor was looking to see just what the hell he was supposed to siphon the gas into. Court had no container, and he drove no vehicle. Court pulled another note from his wallet and pointed to the metal bucket the man had been using as a stool. Court picked it up himself, flipped it over. It would hold 2 gallons or so. The man looked at him like he was crazy, but he nevertheless began sucking on the hose to draw the gas out into the tin bucket. It took a minute and a half to siphon the fuel and complete the transaction, and by the time Gentry returned to his tiny taxi scooter, he was certain he was the most hated man in all of Al-Fasher. Horns honked in chorus behind him. He handed the keys back to the driver, who continued to berate him while he restarted the little putt-putting motor of the vehicle. Court crammed the metal bucket on the floor between his feet. Then he grabbed a fistful of money out of his wallet and, reaching up, waved it next to the complaining Darfuri tribesman. The man shut up and reached for it, but Gentry pulled it back to him, patted the man on the back instead as if to say, "Soon, my friend." The driver pressed on. As he did so, Court opened the cooler of bottled water next to him on the bench. Even in poor lighting from the buildings as they passed them and the headlights of other cars on the street, he could see black sediment in the liquid. Drinking it would have probably given him dysentery, but he was not going to drink it. Instead, he doused himself with it, completely covering his face, his arms, and his clothing. He pulled out a second bottle and did it again, drenching himself in water. The driver looked back over his shoulder at this odd fare, but Court motioned for him to keep his eyes pointed forward. Court opened a third bottle and then a fourth, pouring water all over his clothing and hair and face. The Darfuri man soon pulled over next to a large but aged soccer stadium. He pointed at the busy intersection ahead and then gestured with his hands that it was just to the left. He turned fully around in his seat with his hand out for his money now, and Court reached deep into his wallet. The American pulled out a wad of bills of different color than the Sudanese man expected, but the Darfuri knew euros when he saw them. He nodded slowly, then became more serious when he saw how much he was being handed. 400 euros was enough to buy a brand new rickshaw, the driver realized, and he could not help himself from swallowing hard. It took a few seconds more for the turbaned driver to realize that that was exactly what the Kawaga was asking him to do. After the driver took the money, the waterlogged white man with the tin bucket of gasoline stepped out of the back, unzipped his jumpsuit, stripped to his soaking wet shorts and t-shirt, and handed the jumpsuit over to the driver. It did not take the Sudanese man long to realize he was being asked, no, forced, to change clothes with the white man. He climbed out of his vehicle grudgingly, but quickly, and took off his clothes right there on the side of the street. Passers-by stopped and stared. The Kawaga pulled the long tunic and the brown pants on, pocketed the screwdriver and the flare, cinched the pants tight with a leather belt, and reached up and took the turban off the Darfuri's head and used it to wrap his own face and head in a white mask. Without a word or a nod, the white man removed the cap from the gas tank of the covered scooter and tossed it in the road. Then he hurriedly climbed behind the handlebars and positioned the bucket tightly between his knees. He opened one more bottle of water and doused his new clothing with it, and then he jammed the throttle forward, and the rusty red machine leapt forward and back out into traffic. The Darfuri driver stood in the dirt under a street lamp next to the soccer stadium, no shirt on his back, scratching his head as a crowd converged on him with unbridled curiosity. Court hoped he was not too late. Once Ellen Walsh was taken through the front gates of the ghost house, it would be suicide to even attempt trying to get her, and it would do nothing to help her chances. He just had to do something before the NSS car made it in. Just up ahead, at the last intersection, he saw another traffic jam of crap cars, beasts of burden pulling wood and rusted carts, and NGO vehicles. He jacked the handlebars to the left and bumped up on a little curb, drove straight through men walking home from work or out for dinner or on an evening stroll. White-turbaned men leapt to the side as if for dear life, though the rickshaw was probably not big or powerful enough to do much more than cause bruises or a few broken bones to a pedestrian. He tried to picture the scene ahead because he had no real idea what he was going to find around the corner. But he'd seen his share, more than his share, of secret police HQs in Third World ex-colonial outposts. There would be a squat building with a fortified wall around it, a front gate with a guard shack, and some sort of movable barrier. Often, there would be a sandbagged machine gun emplacement or two, or even an armored personnel carrier at the front. This damn Canadian investigator better appreciate this, he thought to himself. Then, he remembered that if not for him, she would be nowhere near the predicament from which he was now trying to extract her. He was at the left turn now, leaving more screaming and shouting and horn honking behind him. He pulled too hard for the turn, and the little two-stroke machine rocked high, its left rear wheel off the ground for a few seconds before banging back to the dusty pavement, causing the cab of the vehicle to bottom out with an ear-piercing scrape. Gasoline sloshed on his pants leg, but he'd managed to save 80% of the contents of the bucket by lifting his opposite knee to compensate for the tilting in his seat. And there it was, right ahead of him and on the right. The wall was lower than he had expected, and the building was taller and a bit more ornate than he had envisioned. There was an access gate with a guardhouse on the rear side of the road, and some sort of tin shack bunker on the far side. And there was the NSS car, about to make a right turn at the intersection ahead, just beyond the entrance to the ghost house. Shit, thought Court, not going to make it. But he floored the little rickshaw and leaned forward, hoped against hope something would slow down the sedan's advance on the entrance. A donkey pulling a cart overladen with plastic watering cans entered the intersection in front of the NSS sedan, causing it to slow and honk. It was 25 yards tops to the entry drive of the ghost house, and Court knew this was his chance. He would get to the sedan in time, though his odds for success at any part of his plan after that were still pretty lousy. He grabbed the bucket of gas by its rickety handle, held the rickshaw straight by its throttle, and barreled in on the stationary car. Just as the donkey cart began rolling out of the way and the sedan started to drift forward again, Gentry let go of the handlebar, spun out of his seat, and leapt out of the rickshaw. Though he stumbled forward and splashed another 25% of the gasoline from the bucket, he remained on his feet, running into screeching and honking traffic. The rickshaw slammed into the front passenger side door of the NSS car at 20 miles an hour, jolting and denting the car with a crunching crash and knocking it into the wooden cart in front of it. Chapter 20. Horns honked at Gentry, at the accident itself, in annoyance of the delay this would surely cause. Animals brayed at the loud noise of the crash and the ensuing protesting blarings. The NSS car had stopped in the middle of the intersection, its headlights reflecting off of steam pouring forth from its grille. The rickshaw had bounced away and rolled on its side in the street. Gas flowed from its open tank. Court arrived at the passenger side door just as the dazed NSS commander kicked it open. Gentry grabbed the small, bespectacled man by his tie and pulled him free of the wreckage, and then let him go, using both hands now to douse the bucket of gasoline over the man's head. The two soldiers were piling out of the back of the car, and the driver was slowly exiting his side, when Court pulled the road flare from his pants pocket, pulled the lid off the top, and struck the wick on the head. With an explosion of fire and sparks, he held the flare far away from his body with his left hand. With his right, he grabbed the NSS commander by his collar and pulled him tight in a headlock. The soldiers from the back of the car leveled their guns and screamed at him. The NSS subordinate moved around the car, his pistol high in his hands, and screamed at him. Three uniformed guards from the ghost house approaching the wreck lifted their rifles to their shoulders and screamed at him. Court stood in the middle of the intersection, holding the commander tight by the neck. He spoke softly into his ear in English. "Reach for your gun, and I burn you." The man said nothing, but his hands pushed out wide from his body, away from the holster on his hip under his suit coat. Court whipped the sparkling flare close to the man, and then jerked it away quickly. "If they shoot me, I drop this. If I drop this, you die. Understand?" The man clearly understood. He raised his arms high and began shouting into the chaos around him. Court understood the Sudanese Arabic. "Lower your guns! Put them down! Put them down! Do not shoot!" No one lowered their guns, but no one fired them either. Court continued to yank the small NSS man to the left and to the right, tried to keep himself a moving target in the hopes that some sniper on the ghost house roof or some overzealous sentry or passing cop might think twice instead of feeling confident enough to pop a shot off in his direction. While he did this, careful to keep the buzzing and burning road flare near enough to the secret police commander to be dangerous, but not so close as to start an inferno, he chanced a look in the back of the black sedan. Ellen Walsh had not moved. She stared at him, her wide, stunned eyes obvious under the car's interior light. "You okay?" he asked. He moved around quickly to the other side of the car, still trying to preclude any hot shots from feeling lucky. "You okay?" he asked from the left of the vehicle now. She nodded blankly, and he worried she may have been in shock. "Pay attention. Get in the driver's seat. Hurry, now. Get it together." He moved forward and back a few feet, ducked down, nearly pulling the secret policeman to the pavement. The blaring horns of the cars and trucks and bleeding animals of the carts crowding the intersection continued unabated. Court knew the road flare would not last another minute. In 60 seconds, he'd have to either be gone from the scene or be prepared to torch the scene. He strongly preferred the former. Ellen finally scooted out of the back seat. She seemed confused more than terrified. He yelled at her mercilessly, a profanity-laced tirade designed to focus her and bring her back into the here and now, to convince her that all the danger around her was real and her own actions were the only thing that would save her from it. "That's right," his tone softened as she sat behind the wheel. "You're doing good. See if the engine will start." The deputy NSS man from the airport backed away from the car slowly, moving to Court's left. Gentry worried that the man was thinking about taking a shot, planning first to get away from the fireball that was sure to follow. His boss would die, no doubt, but for all Gentry knew, this clown was next in line for a promotion and saw an opportunity to create the vacancy he needed to make that happen. Behind this man, nearly a dozen African Union peacekeepers arrived, jumping out of the back of an APC. They began waving their rifles around at the scene demonstratively, but warily, not sure what the hell was going on, but damn sure they weren't going to let anyone in the crowd target them without blowing the entire fucking crowd apart in a fusillade of bullets. Perfect. There were now easily 25 guns pointing at Gentry, and he had no doubt that the vast majority of people pointing these guns didn't really give a damn if this shitty little hostage of his burned alive. Time to go. Ellen got the car started, and Court pulled his NSS captive up the north-south portion of the intersection a few feet, told Ellen to drive alongside him. She backed the sedan away from the donkey cart, and the rear bumper scooted the demolished rickshaw a few feet before she put it in drive. Court let go of the secret policeman's neck, but continued to wave the flare over him as he reached across the man's body and pulled the pistol from his hostage's hip holster. He racked the slide one-handed by hooking the rear sights on his belt and slamming the gun down and forward. Court now pointed this gun at the other NSS man, who seemed to have thought better of his plan to open fire. Gentry imagined this insane intersection full of weapons would only need the pop of a single gunshot to send every last goddamn rifle opening up full auto on the scene. Maybe the other NSS man figured the peacekeepers behind him would obliterate every breathing creature in front of them if he fired a round from his pistol at the white man. As Ellen drove forward and alongside the gray man, he instructed her to continue slowly. He walked backwards, alongside the open left rear door, leaving the NSS commander in the intersection near the broken rickshaw and the smashed donkey cart and the other vehicles stuck in traffic behind the wreckage on three sides. Court pointed the pistol with his right hand,